So I have the distinct honor of introducing and a friend. For 30 years we've known each other. One of the first people I met when I got to San Diego, I was working as an assistant engineer at a studio, and he came in and worked on a project, and he had this graceful, fastidious sense of detail, you know? And that's like the best thing that you can have as a sound engineer, because it's such an exacting thing, and you also have a record 20 years later you can listen to of your attitude at a particular moment in time. And so he was somebody who was clear and graceful under pressure, and moved on through many music projects and higher levels of work to really what seems to be his life calling, and I think he would say that he finds himself to be an accidental global activist. So you'll learn more about it, but really it's a distinct honor for us to have William Ora with us today.
Present this to you from Nepal. A very dear friend of mine made this for your group.
Thank you so much. Sure.
Wow. Thank you, Mark, Ruth. Well, I'll try to give you a little background on myself and try to make it brief, as probably many of you know it. I get bored, but I came here in 1977 from Michigan, San Diego, and worked for a magazine called Wellbeing Magazine. Anybody remember that? And from the old hippie days? Yeah, I was the art director for that. And San Diego was definitely a starting point for so many things. And was at Balboa Park and met some musicians and started a band. We played here for at least 10 years. And it was called Heart Space. And it might have been a little corny now, but it was all real heartfelt. And it was positive affirmations through music, and we had many events here over the years, and I'm sure some of you have attended quite a few of them. From there, I got more into the music business and was with EMI Records for 18 years till 2002, and that's when everything fell apart in the music business, when everything became free. And literally, the walls came crashing down in LA, where for all of us, where we were working. And we had a great run through the 80s and 90s, but everything pretty well collapsed with Napster. So I was kind of forced into an early retirement. And I'm 50, and you start putting out resumes around in the Hollywood and music area, and that's too old. And so I had a great career with 125 records and my own personal solo albums and band albums and all this stuff, and I didn't have anything I could find to do. And for 3 years before that, I had sponsored a child in India, a Tibetan refugee girl. We've exchanged letters, and I just love that. So I decided I wanted to go visit her. I'd just take a trip. I've never been in that area before. I thought I'd go one time. So I went with a group of people that wanted to see their kids, and I went in 2002. And my life has changed dramatically since that trip to where I am standing right here. So I thought I'd go one time, met the child, met some other kids that were refugees. They gave me their little bios and what they wanted. They just wanted school funds to be able to go to school for supplies and their monthly fees. So I brought those letters back, sat around with my friends at work and my family, and they read the letters, and I'll take this one, I'll take that one. And accidentally, I started a sponsorship project. I'm proud to say that over the years it developed, and I started going back on my own money for at least 5 years, and went a number of times. In 2005, I went five times. That's the world's longest commute. It is. So I fell in love with the place, I fell in love with people, and the first year I was there in 2002, I found a young man there. I was walking around a square, and a young man came up to me, said he wanted to practice his English, could he spend the time with me, so we had the afternoon together, and I found out his condition was basically child labor. He was working in a hotel in a basement, cleaning teapots for food. And it's a very common situation there if you don't have any family or you're on your own. So we got him in school. he told me stories about being in the basement, had a little window there, and saw kids go by in their shoes going to school, and that's what he wanted. He could just see the shoes. So his name was Shyam. Sponsored him, got him in school. Then I got another sponsor to put him through college. And then he's been inviting me to his village for years, which is really very remote, but it was during the Civil War there between the Maoists and the army, and that area that he lived in was one of the bad areas, so I was recommended by State Department not to go out there. So in 2006, our beloved President Carter went there and helped negotiate a deal, and they signed a peace treaty there. And so I went out to his village, and I was the first foreigner to ever go to this place. And they've never had a school there, and he wanted me to help him with just some books. So here was another deal I thought was just a one-time thing, and we brought books. He had been for years in college. I wasn't aware of this, but we would send him money to buy books, but he didn't buy books. And so what's the deal with this? Well, he was taking that money and making Xerox copies of books. And then he was putting on his backpack and taking a motorcycle and driving for 16 hours through a civil war to get these Xerox copies. I'm sorry. So I went there, and we decided to take some books there, and we took the first color books they ever saw, the first coloring crayons they'd ever seen. And it was really profound. We started with 10 kids underneath a tree, and I'm happy to tell you I just returned from there, and we have 150 children and a building and all sorts of things. Yeah, it's great. So my mother gave me the first money, my brother, my friends, and we just built one little room and then another room and expanded it. And every year it's growing. The message is getting out there and people want to participate. What I've learned from doing this is that you think you're doing one thing, and there's these branches of a tree that start going out, and it's becoming not overwhelming, but it's taken over my life. I mean, it's what I do 7 days a week full time. And we met a group of mothers out there that had enough on the trafficking issue. We're only an hour away from the border of India, and the trafficking of young girls there is insidious. And they had enough, so they came up to me and said, could I help in some way? And my mother gave me $100. Usually she gives me $100 to $300 every trip. I put it in my pocket, and wherever it's supposed to go, you know. And they wanted some uniforms. They wanted to go out and start doing performances and teach the girls about the trafficking issues. But they needed uniforms. They wanted to look nice and have costumes and so on. So gave the $100. That was how we started the Mother Society. And we're 6 years into that program, and I'm proud to tell you it's really doing an amazing, amazing thing. There's a point to where I help initiate these things because you see the need and you can fill it, and then you step back and you just watch the culture happen. And that's where I'm just watching it now and just finding out what their needs are. So they go to various villages, and there's 37 women and some of the girls, and they reenact the way a trafficker might come in and come to a girl and approach her and offer money in a carpet factory. Here's an advance for your family, and so on and so forth. There's all these little techniques. It's very easy. It's very, very easy to steal a child there. It's about $900 a month. And this is in an area the size of West Virginia. You know, that's just not acceptable. But they don't know any better. Everybody's an uncle, everybody's an aunt. So unfortunately, we have to teach stranger danger to innocent children, and we have to. So they do it the best, and they come and they start doing dance and music. You're out in the field and you're working, what's going on here? And you come and join. They save the play part till later, till everyone's there, and they lay it on them. In the first years, sometimes the men would just, I just get back to work. This is important to me. So over the years, that expanded. And then in 2007, in 2002, in the record company, we had a young man come in that had a record idea, a film he wanted to do called Playing for Change. His name's Mark Johnson. And it was just an idea at that time. So I met him, but then we didn't connect for a number of years. And then he contacted me again. He said, I understand you're going to Asia a lot. I'm doing a movie around the world. Could you maybe take our camera people through Asia and we'll shoot there? And I said, great. And then I didn't hear from him for 6 months. I thought it was another Hollywood thing that, you know, I'll never hear from him again. And then he called me up and said, we're ready to go. We're leaving in 2 weeks. I said, well, what are you talking about? Oh, we're going, aren't we? 40 days. Here's the schedule, so on and so forth. We got 4 camera people coming. They're from MTV. You meet them at the airport. You have Jeeps. I need musicians. You got bands ready. Bam, take us. So that was really one of the most outrageous times of my life. I don't know if any of you have seen the film, the first film, but... And that's where we merged, where the sponsorship project and the Playing for Change energy kind of merged. So I'm a legal nonprofit or import sponsorship project, but then, as you know, Playing for Change has a foundation. So they decided to try a music program in our school out in Tintali Village, and we did that. So we hired teachers, came out, and then I told them about the Mother Society, and they wanted to sponsor that. So we started getting funding for that and enhancing that program. So since then, I've created 6 programs, 5 in Nepal and 1 in Thailand, and they're all interconnected now. And for those of you that can stay afterwards, I'm going to show some slides of our recent work there. This is such a joyous group, and that I feel I don't want to... I've just come back from Nepal. I was working there for 2 months, and it's something I haven't got over. And so... you'll have to forgive me if I'm not completely myself. It's a very emotional thing for me. But I'm really grateful to be here to speak about it. So obviously the earthquake happened. You all know about that. And thankfully our school in Tintali Village is fine. We had a few cracks, but that was to the west. But unfortunately we had real problems in Kathmandu in the northern part. Because I have so many friends there on Facebook, that instantly the texts start coming in with photos. So I'm in my home in Ojai, in bed, comfortable, and I'm just getting all this stuff. What can you do? Can you help? And it's a little overwhelming. And fortunately, we had funds, so we started getting out food right away, and we funded a medical team there. And so we did a lot in the first week or so, and I felt good about that. We could respond right away, and I knew we had already had a 12-year relationship there with a team of people, so it was like we had music programs and we have administrators, so I just have to steer them this direction. So we didn't have to create something from scratch, so we could respond right away. I would love to show you some of those images and what we did and how it all evolved and how we learned as we did it, and I'm an expert now in some things I thought I would never be an expert in. But I can build a shelter right now if we need one, out of bamboo. So yeah, the Buddhists say what has a front has a back. And the front of the earthquake is very hard. But the backside of the youth, it's very powerful, and you'll see both if you stick around. I'll show you the slides. You'll see it's both right there. It's very encouraging. We were able, with a small amount of money, to do quite a bit, and there's a movement to send me back right away. And I may be going here in about another 30 days, which I can't quite believe, but I just got back. But now's the time for action, and I don't want to spend too much time on it, but it's just something that's so deep. People ask me, what's the takeaway from it? And I want to work through this, and maybe through the prayer group you can help me. But there's a lot of anger and bitterness about how they're not doing enough, and the money's there, and there's a lot of cheating, a lot of scamming, a lot of hoarding. And I witnessed, that was the heartbreak for me. The work itself's not a big deal. You can find a family in need, build a shelter, bring them together. We can get music programs. We can have the kids come out and play. We did a number of events where we had art projects where the kids could express themselves through art. All of that was beneficial. You'll see photos of that and the beauty of that. Very effective. But I'm afraid I ran into too many people that took advantage. And then that's black and white. Then it got to a gray area. One young lady I know, 20 years old, she texts me. She's 2 hours away from Kathmandu. The village is flat. We have nothing. No one's come here. You know, I'm, again, in California. So I can send $350 a day on ATM. So 2 days in a row, we send $350. We rent two trucks. We fill them up with rice and lentils. And then I have my four friends drive there. Two of them are musicians. And they got shots, and we're gung-ho. We're ready to go. She knows we're coming. We get an hour into down the road, and people are in the road like this, and they come up, and my friend throws down the window. Yeah, what do you need? They open up the door, and they pull them out, hold them. They just hold them. Brother, brother, we need this more than you. And empty the trucks. And he said, families kept coming over the hillside. And what do you do about that? You know, what would you do? You know, I ran into those things where it wasn't black and white. And it made me evaluate, well, what would I do? You know, we had people delivering rice. You have food? No. So here's a bag of rice. And another group would come the next day. Do you have food? Do you say that you got the bag of rice yesterday, or don't you? These are family. So people were hoarding. They would get more. The earlier you were in the run, the more rice you got, and didn't get to the end. I never looked at those kinds of things before, you know. And that was the heartbreak, because I didn't know where the line is on that, where you take care of your own, or you make sure you share. You know, and it makes me wonder, heaven forbid, we ever have anything like that here. You know, we'll be all making those decisions, you know, really quickly. So that's part of the process I'm trying to get through. And it's not Nepal. I think that's human nature. We built some shelters for some people. We'd partner with them. Then we found out later they were reselling them to two or three other groups, so like doubling and tripling their money. You know, this is just, you know, so it goes from the area, if you don't know, black to gray, and we spent, I would say, half of our trip vetting what was real. We would go to the families, we would eat with them, we'd see their condition of their house, it's split open, they got the red circle and the line through it, we know, you know, they have to get out of their facility. So we had to spend a lot of time just making sure stuff was real. But you kind of understand, too, you know, it's just something I hope nobody here has to ever experience. But the other side of that coin was for the youth. The youth came out in power, and we came with Playing for Change, and we got our program collapsed, the music programs. They didn't come together after the earthquake. Three of our students lost their home and a teacher, and they were all worried about them. What could they do? And so when I came in there, I got all the kids back together. We got 65 kids. We went over to see the students that didn't have a home. We built two shelters right away. So we got them, family of nine, we got them in two shelters, just bamboo and tin. But the students, when I talked to them, you know, they just felt like, oh, we thought we were going to die. We don't have any future, no hope. And they saw things kids shouldn't see, you know. And so the music program, that's all I got. That's all we got. We play music. Then it became real clear. And it's so obvious now. But we had them come to the other villages where we were putting in shelters and have them entertain the villagers, have them minister to the kids themselves, the ones that were hurting the most. And I don't need to tell you what happened. The endorphin rush comes in, the compassionate act you're doing for others. And I go, oh, this is it. This is it. This is what we do. We just get them serving. Just get them serving. I can talk all day long, but nothing does it like them feeling like they're helping their own people. You know, so that became kind of the focus of everything. Just engaged all our students into the rescue efforts and the aid efforts. And it did. It turned them all around, and they were inspiring other kids. Again, I just stepped back at a certain point, because it's not about us coming and saving them. It's their country. So I hope I'm giving you an even-handed kind of approach, because it's not like it's a sad tale. It's one that's challenging me. You know, all I thought I knew spiritually, you know, I just have to question, you know, what would I do? and those things. How real is that? And like I say, heaven forbid anything like that ever happen here. How would we treat our neighbors? So would we take our share? Would we take more? You know, I don't even have that answer for myself, to be honest with you. And I thought that was appropriate to bring up. I'm not sure why. But it's the essence of the story of being there for me. But they will rise again, and the music program with Playing for Change Foundation, they jumped on board. I had one guy write me a check for $5,000. I got a grant from an anonymous woman that read on Facebook, gave me $5,000. I go there flush with cash. We're ready to go do it. And we built, I'm happy to tell you, we got, right, as of today, 49 families in shelters. You know? Yeah. Yeah. But there's over 100,000 right in Kathmandu that don't have any shelter right now. You know? And we just went through the monsoons and the winter's coming in, and there's nothing going on there. So I'll show you some of those images. And there's talk about me going back November to build another series of shelters. We've been doing different, the Quonset hut style, and different things that are kind of cheap and quick, but work against the monsoon that will stand the storms and so on, so at least have something. You know, we always think about air, water, food as being our needs. Sometimes people throw in the word shelter. Well, I've seen that. You know, you don't have that in the black rain, they call it. You know, you don't have nothing. And they got kids, and they're trying to dress up and go to school like anybody else. You know, they're trying to help their kids and everything. So it's very difficult if your place is a pile of bricks. And I just never imagined seeing anything like that before. And obviously doing this work is very gratifying. There's no question about it. It's tiring. It's physically demanding. And it's not sanitary there. But I hope you can stick by and see some of the photos I put together for you to see. And I thought you would at least like to know at least my perspective on what was happening there. How much am I good? Oh, I haven't been. The mic's not off yet. Okay. Yes, Playing for Change. I work for them now on the foundation. It's wonderful because they pay my expenses there, so the sponsorship project, all the money that comes in that goes into that school. It's a kind of a sweet deal. And foundation wins because I've created these programs over there that really work for them. So I found a little sweet spot there, and this is my sunset career. And I'm just going to ride this out. I didn't expect the earthquake. Nobody did. So everything's kind of changed dramatically. At least the focus for now, since the shelter was an issue. And like I say, towards the end here, after we're doing a number of individual shelters, there was this feeling people were still isolated. You're in your little tin shack here, and then you're over there. And emotionally, we weren't feeling right about that. So we decided we wanted to do one community of shelters and share toilets and even a playground for the kids. So we leased some land there, and we built 18 shelters with 4 toilets and a little playground area. And that model we're really excited about. That one really seemed to change the whole spirit of the people. We just finished that before I left. I've been back about a month. And I'd like to show you photos of that. And that's what I want to do more of, is these sheltered communities. We can lease the land. We find there's a lot of farmland there, and there's some, you either find an elder or a rich person that has a lot of land, and you make a deal. We got this land, it's quite large, for $200 a year. And I put my thumbprint on paper, and they have a government guy come out, and we all sign some papers that are right there on the spot, one paper on the spot. So we're going to do more of that, but the word's gotten out, and just the last one, we're looking at land now, it's $500 a year. So it's getting that. But even so, we can lease it for 2 or 3 years, just get people in a place. If you were fortunate enough to have property there, and you lost your home and you survived, well, you can build a shelter on your property. But if you're renting, what do you do? So we rented that. You'll see a couple things we did for some people there. I'm most distressed about that because we were in homes that they shouldn't be living anymore. They're open, and they're already red tagged, and but there's kids sleeping there, and they don't have any place to go, and no one's kicking them out, and they don't know where to go. So you can only imagine, if you've lost so many homes and there's so many people needing shelter, you can imagine the rent going down? No, it doubled. Yeah, it doubled. 11,000 rupee a month was the average price, $110. Now it's literally over $200, $220 a month. That's way beyond the capacity of most people. So that's a real issue, too. And so we started leasing lots. We would find an empty lot in Kathmandu, find the owner. Said, you're not doing anything with it. You want to rent it for a couple of years? Ah, it's a pretty easy pitch. Yeah, free money, just sitting there. And then we're building shelters on there. It's a little funky, you know, a little basic, but it gets them a place. We did it for a family of eight, you'll see. Grandmother with four kids and another woman she takes care of that's almost blind. And I mean, it's just, you meet the people and you go, oh, good Lord, you know, you got to do something. So we got them in shelters, and this is going to be a long-term issue for them. And clearly, you know, I do the sponsorship project in the school and the Mother Society. We got all these things going. And those, the effort has focused towards the earthquake, so the other areas have not gotten the attention they should. So you can, you know, stuff just starts expanding on what the need is. And I think the last thing I'll say is for the Mother Society, for 2 years, they've been asking for some sort of vocational training. They've never been educated. These are women that have never received an education. Our first year, by the way, on a music program, we had zero girls. We had one girl that was there that was wanting to try to play guitar, and then when we called all the kids together, whoever wants to do it, it was all the guys. So we go out and we start looking into it, and we ask the parents. It's a waste of time. It's a waste of time to educate a girl. You know, that's hard to take. I'm happy to tell you, a majority of our students are girls now. Yeah, no question about that, yeah. And it's normal now. You know, once it changes within the community, it starts spreading out. So even women's rights issues, things like that, was never spoken of there. And now with Mother Society, they come out fist pumping, yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. So they wanted some training and they wanted to learn some sewing. So I'm gonna be pleased to show you this program of, we brought in 10 sewing machines and built a building for them, and I hired a teacher for a year and we started a program. And you'll see that is such a glorious thing, because I didn't expect, the women were very excited. We had an open house and they come in, they didn't even know how to put a thread in a needle, you know, just at the very beginning, old style, pump style, but they were excited to learn something. And then that was the introduction. The next day, the place is locked. They're waiting for the key. The women are lining up ahead of time. And I go over and I'm hanging out with them. And I'm just trying to share this because it's not on video or anything. And for some reason, it sticks strong in my mind. They open up the door and the women run in because there's 10 places, but there's like 30 women. So you have to take your turn. And they ran in like screaming like girls, elbowing each other for a seat. I go, ladies, please, ladies, you know. Please, we'll all take turns here. But it was that kind of pure, unadulterated joy of them coming in to learn, and that was there for them, that it's not fully expressed on any media I have. I just saw it, and I wanted to share that with you. And then the other one last thing, and then would be last year you folks helped us with a cook stove. And if we have time afterwards, I have a short video on that. It's very dynamic. We've put in 60 now. And these cook stoves are amazing if you haven't seen them, but it's a very simple design from an Indian graduate student, and it just basically pipes the smoke outside because they all had open fire pits. But we got to go back now after 9 months of them having it and go interview the families having it. Oh my God. I would go in joking saying, well, if you don't like this, we'll put your old fire pit back. Oh no, don't even say that. Don't don't talk like that. We don't want to get rid of it. And I think the most dramatic part of that is we're finding they're using up to 70% less wood to cook the same amount of food. And I'm sorry, but I rarely see the men carrying the wood. It's usually grandma. And I mean, it's a load I can't pick up. You'll see images of it, and they'll walk for an hour or so because it's not in a neighborhood. They got to go into the jungle for it. So to actually use 70% less wood for your cooking is a dramatic change, let alone the smoke going out of the place. So this is real good work. We're going to continue this program. No question about that. That and the Mother Society continuing. I'm hoping the earthquake relief, that soon other things will kick in, because what we're doing is quite minimal in the whole scheme of things. But for the people that we've helped already, they wouldn't say it's minimal at all. You know, it's life-changing for them. So I hope you can stick around later and see the slideshow. It's about 20 minutes, and I'll try not to bore you with it, but I've kind of put it together selectively so you get an idea of overview. I don't want to overwhelm you with all our activities, but I'm overwhelmed with all the activities. And thank you very much for the invitation. It's nice to be here. I'm still halfway there. You know, I haven't left, and so it's a very unusual thing for me, and I feeling all the spirit in the room and the intention is very healing, and I know that you all have compassion towards these activities, and I appreciate that, and let's hope that maybe over this next course of this year we could create together something to benefit them, because I'm here to give you the situation, what we're doing so far, and looking for ideas of how we can take it to another level. All right? All right, thank you.